Let's talk about a new way to watch television. A service called Aereo offers an alternative to traditional broadcast television. In fact, it is seeking to be a kind of alternative to your cable company. It's backed by the broadcasting mogul Barry Diller, and it's causing waves. Waves of lawsuits. Let's talk about this with Rich Jaroslawski. He's writing about Aereo for Bloomberg News. Welcome back to the program, Rich.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Okay, so I guess the basic concept here is you're watching broadcast TV and maybe eventually more and more cable channels over the internet. But how does that work?
Well, Aereo, it's a very interesting company. They basically, in each locality where they're going to be operating, they have a data center with thousands of tiny antennas, just like the ones that you'd find on many rooftops. And the antennas pull in the over-the-air broadcast signals and then stream it to you over the internet.
Okay, so this is working already in New York City, for example. I could get WCBS or one of the old line network broadcast stations over the internet, but why do I need to do that when I could just turn on the TV and watch it directly?
Well, one reason is because this will stream directly to your smartphone or to your tablet as well as over-the-air TV if you have a Roku or a Apple TV. The service costs only about $8 a month, and for that you not only get all the over-the-air TV signals in your home market, but you also get 20 hours worth of stored DVR programming. So it's a combination DVR and over-the-air television for a fraction of what even a basic cable package would cost you.
Okay, does that mean that if I'm in New York, the first market where this is being tried, that I can get rid of the cable company entirely and still get all the same programming?
For the over-the-air broadcast networks, for CBS, ABC, NBC, Fox, as well as for a bunch of lesser-known but still over-the-air signals.
Public broadcasting, for example.
Public broadcasting, PBS Kids, that's absolutely what it means. They set me up with a trial account, even though I'm not in New York, so that I could try the service for a while. And I was pulling in 31 channels over Aereo.
31, but not the full range?
Definitely not the full range. What's missing, because of litigation that's going on between the service and many of the networks, are all the big cable networks. There was no Disney Channel. There's no ESPN. There's no HBO. And really, for those services to start showing up on Aereo, it's going to take some resolution of all the legal challenges that are going on right now.
What do the cable companies think of this service that's starting?
Well, the TV networks are suing Aereo, which has been in operation since last year in New York City. But so far, they have not prevailed. They attempted to get an injunction to shut the service down. They failed at that. They're appealing. It's now at the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. But in the meanwhile, the company has not only continued to operate in New York, but has announced plans to expand to 22 more cities starting in the spring.
Let me make sure I understand why cable companies would not like this. I guess the average local cable company is to some extent a monopoly. Does this break their monopoly?
Well, it certainly does. If, for example, all you really wanted were your local stations and HBO, what the cable companies don't want you to be able to do is to say, just give me my local stations and HBO and cut my bill. That's exactly what you can do with Aereo. You can get all the panoply of local stations, and then you could theoretically add apps to your smartphone or to your tablet so that you could then only subscribe to the channels that you actually want, as opposed to paying for bigger packages with many channels that you never view.
Rich Jaroslawski, who writes for Bloomberg News. Thanks very much, Rich.
Thank you.
NPR's business news starts with ogling Google. Google Glass is the company's digital interactive eyewear. It's been in the works for a while, and as NPR's Steve Henn reports, Google is now inviting members of the public to try them out. But there's a catch. To get a pair, you have to win a contest by coming up with creative uses for the gadget, and then you'll have to hand over some cash.
Nothing makes people want something quite as much as a velvet rope that's holding them back. At least that seems to be Google's thinking when it comes to promoting its high-tech augmented reality glasses called Google Glass. This week, Google released a video showing ballerinas, skydivers, kids, trapeze artists, and hot air balloonists filming their lives, hands-free, from a first-person perspective. And they did all this simply by talking to their glasses.
Okay, glass, take a picture.
Now Google says 8,000 pairs of these interactive augmented reality glasses are going to be sold to the public for $1,500 a pop. But first, you have to win the right to buy this gadget by telling Google what kinds of wonderful and creative things you'll do with them.
I would use them to find ways to augment information for disaster responders worldwide.
Gisli Olofsson at NetHope helps disaster responders incorporate new technologies. Communicating hands-free in a disaster area is a big plus.
Exactly.
Google Glass could be perfect, but not all the responses posted online have been as high-minded. Some of the most popular have been, sadly, predictable. Cat videos. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
The Amish are known for living simply. Most of them don't drive. Their homes are not wired for electricity. But somehow, Amish men still want power tools. Robert Smith from our Planet Money team visited an Amish trade show that specializes in adapting modern drills and saws to operate in the old way.
Here's one easy way to tell you're at a trade show for the Amish. A guy tries to sell you a diesel engine speaking Pennsylvania Dutch.
So that is a 5.7 liter motor that sells and about 75 horsepower.
In other words, welcome to the Buckeye Tool Expo in Dalton, Ohio. It is held in a massive hall filled with bearded men in black hats, women in white bonnets, a few horses and buggies tied up outside. The Amish have chosen to forego much of the delights of the modern world, but they still need to drill, still need to sand and cut wood, and this trade expo shows off every loophole by which the Amish can get their hands on power tools. For example, this booth. At first glance, it seems to offer the kind of loud, candy-colored, macho pieces of equipment that you might drool over at Home Depot. But these babies don't plug into a wall. Skylar Feria and Don Christner show me a sander that runs on compressed air.
Almost unlimited, the tools you can convert to air.
Drills, impact wrenches.
Saws, your cable saws.
So I could take a saw that has an electric motor and you just put a different motor on there, like a little windmill?
That's right. It's an air motor. It's not an easy switch, but it is doable, and we do it all the time.
There are 127 vendors here like this one, selling some Amish twist on technology. So how did it happen that a group that vowed to be simple has all of this at their fingertips? Well, anyone here at the Tool Expo could probably tell the story, but the Amish don't like to be recorded. So I asked Sandy Miller, who runs the show. She says what happened was simple demographics. The Amish have large families, and although they've traditionally been farmers, buying more land has become terribly expensive.
There isn't enough farmland now to support all the families like they used to have. Now they have to figure out another trade.
And so many of the young Amish men left the fields, started small manufacturing businesses, woodworking, building furniture, cabinets, the kind of businesses where a power tool can bring in a lot more money. The problem is that the more technology they add, the more technology they need. So, for instance, as some of the Amish were building bigger workshops and factories, they found out that using little gas lamps wasn't cutting it.
They're kind of dark. You just can't see too well. You know, you kind of have things down the bottom shelf you couldn't see or anything like that.
So it's hard to sell products when
you can't see it.
Elva Otto is Amish. In fact, he's the only Amish guy I met who consented to do a recorded interview.
Because I don't know how to keep my mouth shut.
So Otto was telling me about this problem of the dim Amish workshops, about how his company, Daystar, came up with an electricity-free solution. They developed industrial skylights, special reflective light tubes that you install on the roof of your workshop, and it funnels the sunlight into the space. It's kind of amazing. Sure, you could call it a loophole, but Otto prefers to call all of this stuff ingenuity.
I have had a guy make the remark that it takes more technology to be Amish than it doesn't, because most people can take something and plug it into the wall. Well, we've got it to figure out, okay, we can't use electricity for this, so then we get creative and figure out how to make something work.
Sometimes that means a new invention, but often it's simply finding a new use for an old tool. Down the road in a big tent, Amish buyers are bidding on piles of used tools. The sellers often come from a different world. They're non-Amish guys in baseball caps, who have trucked in old equipment.
There's sawmills, there's planers, there's joiners, there's woodworking tools that are specialized tools that do a certain job.
That's Steve Andrews, who helps run the auction. He says stuff that might seem out of date in a modern factory is perfect for the needs of the Amish. And there's something here for everyone. Each Amish community has slightly different rules, so some groups allow generators and batteries. Then there's the Old Order Amish, who might be searching for belts and pulleys to run woodworking machines. But regardless of where they stand on the technological divide, there is an entertainment value to this show. There's a universal thrill in watching a machine do something that a human can't. There was this nice moment outside the tent where guys in baseball caps rushed down and all these other guys in the Amish hats came over to watch a giant diesel-powered log splitter. And with each log that gets split, you can see how the Amish are moving down the well-trodden path of the Industrial Revolution, just using different power sources. And you can see where this is all heading. One booth at the show offered an Amish computer. Battery-powered, no audio, no video, certainly no internet. Just an old-fashioned spreadsheet and word processor for business. 30-year-old technology with a brand new market. Robert Smith, NPR News.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The internet is the new battleground.
We know foreign countries and companies swipe our corporate secrets. Now our enemies are also seeking the ability to sabotage our power grid, our financial institutions, our air traffic control systems. We cannot look back years from now and wonder why we did nothing in the face of real threats to our security and our economy.
In his State of the Union address, President Obama said we need to focus more on cybersecurity. That point was driven home this week by a report released by Mandiant, an American security firm, which claims a unit of the Chinese military has been carrying out extensive cyber espionage against the U.S. since 2006. And it goes beyond stealing corporate secrets. The report says agencies that control critical infrastructure, everything from power grids to hydro, have been targeted by Chinese hackers. Is China engaged in cyber warfare against the U.S.? And if it is, why are we so surprised? Doesn't the U.S. do it? Doesn't everybody do it? In this brave new world of cybersecurity, how can we protect our most valuable networks and systems? Our number is 1-800-989-8255 if you'd like to get in on the conversation. You can also tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com. John Lindsay is a research fellow at the University of California Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation. That's at UC San Diego. He joins us. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Is the president overstating the threat?
Well, there is definitely a lot of malicious cyber activity that's happening. The question is whether this really raises to the level of a national security threat, whether because it is a massive transfer of wealth through espionage, or if there are risks to our critical infrastructure on the level of, you know, a large-scale military attack. And there are big debates on both of those questions.
But he is right about all the attacks that are occurring.
Absolutely. We can certainly observe a lot of activity, and especially from China. There is a lot of hacking activity. But again, the question is, how do you relate activity to actual strategic effect? And that is a more tenuous question.
Let's talk about this new report. What kinds of things did we learn from it?
So this new report is fascinating. We've had several very interesting reports over the last several years of hacking, which almost certainly originated in China, but that was always based on looking at the motive, the kinds of targets that were hit, maybe a history of hacking, things like this. This is the first report in the public domain, which makes a very, very strong case for not only China, not only the Chinese military, but this particular unit. So, I think the attribution case in this was pretty good.
So you think that the real news is that it's in the public domain because most people in the business know this already?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, when you look at the kinds of information that they provided, no piece of information on its own was a smoking gun, right? So, I mean, you have internet addresses from China, you have servers that are in China, you have telephone numbers used to verify Gmail accounts that are in China, you have some, you know, Chinese language in some of the code and idiosyncratic behavior and whatnot. So, you know, any of these by themselves don't work, but when you see how you put them all together, that's how you see how the fusion of all that intelligence can help me to make the attribution case. So I think this just helps to highlight the kind of information that people in the forensics business have been tracking for a while.
And in the report, what type of organizations are being targeted?
In the report, they lay out a very wide range. I mean, it's everything from the energy industry to the chemical industry to information technology was one of the big ones. I mean, you name it. And what's very interesting is that there's a pretty good, you know, correlation between that and the strategic emerging industries that China is interested in developing. So again, this is, you know, the kinds of targets are the kinds of things that, you know, China would be interested in.
Something like our infrastructure, like our electrical grid, things like that?
Sure, but again, you know, you have to ask what is the reason that they're looking at these things. I mean, are they interested in finding out information about how it works so that maybe they can improve their own operations economic espionage? Or is this, you know, the toehold for the great cyber Pearl Harbor? And this is where it's, you know, I find that proposition a little bit harder to believe.
Is it more than you think for stealing company secrets or strategies for negotiating with companies that they deal with all the time?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a great deal of theft on all of these things, and you can definitely think of lots of things. There'll be research and development on products and processes that could be valuable. Negotiating plans and strategies, mergers and acquisitions could be incredibly valuable. A lot of stuff, but then all of this information then gets sucked into the Chinese intelligence apparatus. The first question is, well, are they actually getting that information? You know, we know that there's an incredible amount of junk information on networks and on the internet in general. So finding that needle in the haystack when you've got the haystacks growing really quickly is very, very difficult. Then they have to identify that is useful information. Then they have to be able to get that to a customer that can use it. And there's a great deal of bureaucracy in the Chinese state between, you know, the PLA Third Department and the actual state-owned enterprises that might be able to use it. Then they would have to recognize it. So, you know, I guess my bottom line is you can steal text, but you can't steal the context that makes that text really, really valuable. So we see a tremendous amount of information being sucked out that would be potentially useful, but to actually call that a transfer of wealth requires that the Chinese are actually able to do something with it, and that's something that we really do not know anything about, and the Mandiant report did not give us any new information on that front.
But China can't be the only country that's doing this. Don't we all do it?
That's a great point. You know, there was the U.S. government released a report about a year and a half, 2 years ago, that also named Russia as a major player in cyber espionage for economic purposes. But clearly, the U.S. is very involved. You think of Stuxnet, Flame, Dooku, Gauss, a lot of these kinds of things that were designed for, more political and military type espionage. This is certainly a new modality of information collection, and, you know, all countries with advanced intelligence organizations and military are in on the game.
Let me go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Terry in Robbins, Tennessee. Hi, Terry.
Hello.
Hey there.
Ira, thank you.
You're welcome.
My question is, first of all, it's all of the above as far as the uses. But isn't all that outsourcing that we did of sending all of our computer manufacturing and everything to China really showing up to be real cheap now that we're going to have to deal with all of the repercussions?
Are you saying that, and this is an interesting point, if we're buying all our hardware from China, could there not be stuff, Trojan horses and things inside this hardware they're sending us?
Yeah, that's a really important concern. We talk about the security of supply chains and the fact that, you know, China is the factory and the workshop of the world, especially on IT. There could be a lot of backdoors. And, in fact, this is a concern that prompted Australia to ban Huawei, which is the major telecommunications company. They build servers and routers, internet infrastructure. They banned them from bidding on their high-speed backbone project. There also was a House report on Huawei, which recommended against dealing with either Huawei or ZTE for exactly these kinds of reasons. But that kind of shows you that, that concern can have a huge business impact for these corporations. So do they necessarily have an interest in getting involved? Plus, again, I won't get into the technical details, but if you start thinking about, if you put a bug in there, then actually being able to use it at a time and place of your choosing is going to be a really difficult proposition because supply chains are incredibly, incredibly complex. So being able to activate that logic bomb, if you will, and understanding where it is and understanding all of the other complex factors that go into its embeddedness in human and technical systems is a really, really hard thing. So, it's a genuine concern, again, its technical possibility is probably a lot greater than its actual probability.
Is there a high-tech fix to any of this snooping around?
To snooping around, no, I don't think there's a high-tech fix because, the Mandiant report and plenty of other reports from McAfee or Symantec, which kind of walk you through similar information, show you that the weaknesses are less technical and more in exploiting just human gullibility or, people who let their guard down. Some of these phishing emails are incredibly sophisticated, right? I mean, if it comes from your boss and it's talking about a project that you're working on, you're going to be very likely to open that file. Well, you've just installed a rootkit on your server, now they can start moving laterally and compromising other pieces of the network.
So that's how they can do it. You had something called spear phishing, which is even higher level than regular PHIS phishing.
Yeah, so the term spear phishing means that they have identified you and your interests and your relationships. So, for example, you might get an email from one of your colleagues at NPR that says, "Hey, Ira, this is about the story that we're running next week." And you're like, "Oh, okay, that's interesting." You would open that up. Bam, you get hit. So they made it very, very believable because they did the intelligence work on your background, which is now very easy to do because we have Twitter and Facebook and people put all kinds of personal information that they can basically, fake a contact. And
yeah, that's why I don't open my NPR mail anymore. So is there what do you see of the future here? Where is this headed?
I think that there's going to continue to be a lot of noise and friction in cyberspace. This isn't going to get fixed, but I think it's just going to be sort of the general level of background radiation that we will get used to. When militaries go to war, there will be a cyber component, but people don't go to war because of cyberspace. Mm-hmm. They just use it as one tool amongst many. It's going to be a complex world, but I don't think it's necessarily going to be a more dangerous world.
If you unplugged for total security, can you have total security? Let's say you want it just unplugged from the internet and stayed in-house with
things. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the only reason that people can hack your computer is because you're connected to the network. So if you don't connect to anything, you can't do anything, but then it's not very useful. And this gets the fundamental trade-off in a lot of the policies that we're considering. If we get really scared about the threat and we start imposing, technology standards and, all kinds of things that would impact the productivity of our information networks, then you're going to see kind of the great gifts of the information economy start to be whittled away. So right now we just don't have a good sense of how fast the threat is increasing relative to the productivity benefits of computers. And everything that I've looked at says that, for every dollar that we make because of computers in the workplace, we're definitely not losing a dollar. In fact, we're losing, far, far less than that. So,
all right. I got to go, John. Thank you very much. John Lindsay of UC San Diego. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR.
The FAA says it wants to start testing the civilian use of aerial drones here in the U.S. It's already issued special permits to a few police departments to try out the drones. But as NPR's Martin Costi reports, some state lawmakers are putting on the brakes.
Last year, Seattle became one of the first cities to buy police drones. Public reaction here was less gee whiz than what the heck, And after a raucous city council hearing earlier this month, the mayor killed the program. Now the controversy has moved to the state capitol. In a packed hearing room in Olympia, privacy activist Sam Bellomio is proud to say that he was one of those who helped to ground the drones in Seattle.
It's almost like we're back in communist Russia or, you know, Nazi Germany, and these unmanned drones will be another tool for eventual police state.
While he's talking, a toy helicopter suddenly takes to the air.
Oh, is that his unmanned drone?
A state representative is at the controls, having a little fun before the hearing. But lawmakers here are serious about regulating drones. Shankar Narayan of the ACLU of Washington State says it may be now or never.
We don't think this is an issue that the legislature can wait a year to address. We think that these drone technologies are being developed now, and they have already outpaced the public policy debate.
The ACLU counts 21 states considering bills to regulate drones. State lawmakers appear to be reacting to recent moves by the federal government to bring the technology into civilian life. Seattle, for instance, bought its drones with a grant from Homeland Security. That struck many here as an Orwellian move by the feds, and the ACLU's Narayan says state rules will help to put people more at ease.
We think if you have those regulations in place, the public can feel confident that they know what the drones are being used for, and more importantly, that they're not being used to personally surveil them.
The Washington State bill would require police to get warrants for drone surveillance, and they'd have to delete imagery of people not targeted. The bill also creates broad exceptions for emergencies, but some police agencies say it's still too restrictive.
It's patently absurd to do those kind of limitations where we don't have them on manned rotary aircraft, manned fixed-wing aircraft, and all the other technologies that are in place.
Mitch Barker of the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs says the legislature could cripple a promising new crime-fighting technology before it's even been tried. Better, he says, to leave the rules up to the courts.
It's what they do. They outline search and seizure for us. They tell us where government officials can intrude and where they can't, and what is required to do that.
And proponents wonder why drones are being singled out when lawmakers haven't restricted other privacy-piercing technologies like license plate scanners and facial recognition software. Sam Bellomio has a theory about this.
I think the reason why it touches the nerve of American citizens is these are used in the war and in combat. So now they say, well, we want to use drones here in civilization, and so what are we, in a war against citizens?
He admits these drones are not war machines. They're unarmed, and they're practically toys, capable of staying in the air only about 15 minutes. But the way technology moves, he says, that's going to change fast. And he'd rather have restrictions on the books before the sight of hovering drones starts to seem normal. Martin Costi, NPR News, Seattle.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Smartphones have quickly become the dominant technology of our time. Last year, more than 600 million people across the globe bought them. And as NPR's Steve Henn reports, as computing processors get even smaller and materials become even more flexible, we shouldn't expect to be tapping on flat pieces of glass forever.
One of the fun things about covering technology is you get to spend a lot of time talking to smart people about the future, asking what's next. Recently, I was talking to venture capitalist Jason Mendelson, based in Boulder, Colorado.
You know, the PC was around for a long time, then laptops took over the market, now we've got tablets. I can already see what's going to take over the tablet, and it's this technology, which foldable, bendable screens that you can wear on a wrist, put in a pocket, put in your wallet, go, and that's where your compute device is.
Jason had just seen a demo for something called OLED. It's a flexible smart screen, and he was jazzed about the idea of building it into a smart watch.
The Dick Tracy Show!
He's not the only one who thinks smart watches, a la Dick Tracy, and other wearable computing devices have a big future ahead.
My name is Joshua Flood. I'm a senior analyst at ABI Research.
Apple recently filed a patent for a smart, flexible watch, and Google spent much of this week promoting its high-tech interactive glasses called Google Glass.
And these two devices potentially could be absolutely huge.
Joshua Flood believes that in just 5 years, consumers will be buying hundreds of millions of these kinds of devices. If Flood's right, soon a lot of our personal technology will feel like it came straight out of comic books or sci-fi thrillers. Google Glass could let all of us see the world kind of like Arnold Schwarzenegger did in the movie Terminator. Google Glass layers pictures and data right over your field of vision. It's like having a tiny screen in the corner of your eye. This week, Google released a video showing skydivers, ice sculptors, and trapeze artists filming their exploits, hands-free, simply by talking to their glasses.
Okay, Glass, take a picture.
But talking to your glasses might not be the only new odd behavior on the horizon. We could end up talking to a tiny device connected to our teeth. A startup called Sonitus could replace your earbuds with a device you slip over your molars. It uses bone conduction in your head to transmit sound. Last year, the company's founder, Amir Abulfati, let me try one out.
Oh my God.
I tucked the device over my teeth and suddenly Led Zeppelin invaded my brain.
Oh, that's really cool.
But really, is anyone ever going to use this?
There's a segment on the Get Smart movie that he puts a device in his mouth and is communicating via a bone conduction device through the teeth.
Of course, Maxwell Smart also used a shoe phone. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.